From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Alec Baldwin. He just won the Best Supporting Actor Award from the National Board of Review for his performance in the new film The Cooler, which is set in an old Vegas casino. Baldwin is also one of the stars of The Cat in the Hat. Also today, Al Roker of The Today Show. He has a new holiday cookbook, but he can't eat large servings of the dishes he recommends. Last year, after giving up on dieting, he underwent gastric bypass surgery. He's lost over 100 pounds. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. There are reports that former Vice President Al Gore has agreed to endorse Howard Dean for the Democratic presidential nomination. Sources close to Gore are being quoted as saying the party's 2000 presidential candidate will throw his support to Dean at an event in New York City's Harlem tomorrow, then campaign with the former Vermont governor in Iowa. The ink is still wet on the Medicare overhaul bill signed today by President Bush, but Democrats are already vowing to try to change it. NPR's Julie Rovner reports.
At a rally on Capitol Hill, House and Senate Democrats said the mostly Republican-backed bill would do more harm than good for seniors who lack coverage for prescription drugs. Texas Congressman Chet Edwards said he'll introduce legislation to repeal a provision that prohibits the U.S. government from bargaining with drug makers to get better prices.
Well, folks, if we're in a fight with the drug companies, the bill the president signed into law today just tied both arms behind our back.
Democrats also want to roll back provisions that would give new subsidies to private health plans, and they want to add language to make it easier for Americans to purchase lower-cost medications from Canada. With Republicans in charge of both the House and Senate, however, Democrats acknowledge changes will most likely have to wait until after the 2004 elections. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
South Dakota Congressman Bill Janklow has been found guilty on all counts in a vehicular manslaughter case. The jury deliberated about 5 hours before convicting Janklow of manslaughter, reckless driving, running a stop sign, and speeding. Janklow was accused of killing a motorcyclist in a collision in August. The former four-term governor of South Dakota could face as much as 10 years in prison. In Iraq today, three soldiers from the newly arrived Stryker combat brigades were killed when part of a road collapsed during a combat patrol north of Baghdad. Strykers, the Army's new armored infantry carriers, were sent to Iraq to help counter guerrilla attacks on U.S. forces. NPR's Eric Westervelt reports.
Three Stryker battalions from the Fort Lewis, Washington-based 2nd Infantry Division only recently arrived in Iraq with their new 8-wheeled troop carriers that Army officials hope will play a key role in counterinsurgency efforts. During a combat patrol north of Baghdad, the Army says an embankment on an unimproved road collapsed, causing two of the new Stryker vehicles to roll over into a nearby canal. The accident killed three soldiers and injured one. Meantime, another U.S. soldier was killed when insurgents attacked soldiers guarding a gas station in Mosul. Also in that city, three Americans were wounded when a roadside bomb struck a patrol. Army commanders in Iraq say violent attacks on U.S. forces have in fact declined to about 18 a day from 35 a day just 2 weeks ago. Eric Westervelt, NPR News, The Pentagon.
In stocks, the Dow gained 102 points to close at 99.65. This is NPR News. The task force that's investigating a string of 14 shootings in the Columbus, Ohio area says it's looking at a shooting incident this afternoon at a local trucking company. Officials say they're not sure today's shooting is linked to any of the others, one of which killed a woman nearly 2 weeks ago. Ohio Public Radio's Joe Ingles reports.
Franklin County Sheriff's Detective Steve Martin says the task force is looking at a shooting in suburban Columbus in which some semi-trucks were fired upon while parked at a local freight company. Martin isn't saying whether he thinks that incident is connected to the string of shootings since May, but he says any reports of similar incidents are under the watchful eye of the task force.
Anything that comes in, regardless of where it's at in the county, in the city, will be compared with what we have.
Martin says the task force is using an FBI computer system to track and evaluate leads. The shootings of 12 vehicles, one house, and one school all in the same area, have been connected. One of the shootings led to the death of a 62-year-old woman. For NPR News, I'm Joe Ingles in Columbus, Ohio.
Police in Grand Forks, North Dakota say they're expanding their search for Drew Chaudine, the 22-year-old college student who disappeared from a mall parking lot last month. Grand Forks Police Chief Michael Kirby says police will take a more detailed look at certain areas. The Associated Press is quoting a source close to the investigation as saying that police have found a knife and blood matching that of Drew Chaudine in the car of Alfonso Rodriguez, the ex-convict who's accused of kidnapping her. In stocks today, the NASDAQ Composite Index gained 11 points to close at 1948. The S&P 500 was up 7 to 1,069. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from AAAS and its journal, Science, advancing science, serving society, and promoting science literacy, on the web at aaas.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Alec Baldwin, has starred in such films as The Hunt for Red October, Glengarry Glen Ross, The Getaway, Outside Providence, Staten, Maine, and Pearl Harbor. He's in the new film, The Cat in the Hat. Last week, Baldwin won this year's Best Supporting Actor Award from the National Board of Review for his performance in the new film, The Cooler. His character, Shelley Kaplow, runs an old Vegas casino. New York Times film critic A.O. Scott wrote, "Shelley is both a brute and a sentimentalist, and Mr. Baldwin swivels elegantly from viciousness to self-pity, from utter rottenness to something that might be mistaken for nobility." In the film, Baldwin's casino partners think he's out of touch with the times. They've sent in a new guy who wants to run the place and give it a makeover. Here's the new guy, played by Ron Livingston, in a meeting with Alec Baldwin.
Shelley, I want you to know that I have nothing but the utmost respect for you. You've done a tremendous job with the Shangri-La over the last 16 years, and I don't think anybody can dispute that.
Yeah, nobody doubts that, Shelley.
But the business has changed. Just take a look at the Strip. You see what I'm talking about.
What? You mean that Disneyland Mook Fest out there? Huh? Come on, you know what that is? Huh? That's a f***ing violation is what that is. Something that used to be beautiful. Used to have class, like a gorgeous, high-priced hooker with an exclusive clientele. And then along comes that Steve Wynn sucker and knocks her up and puts her in a f***ing family way. Now she's nothing but a cheap, fat whore hiding behind too much f***ing makeup. I look at her, I see all her f***ing stretch marks. It makes me want to cry because I remember the way she used to be. Am I right?
Well, there's no arguing the bottom line. Those places are raking it in. And the Shangri-La as she is now can't compete with that.
You think I'm trying to compete with that? You think that's what we're about, trying to bring in the f***ing stroller crowd fresh off some f***ing an e-ticket ride, trying to break the house on red and black? Fremont has never been about that bullshit. This is where old time and real money come to play.
Alec Baldwin, welcome to Fresh Air. Let me ask you to describe your part in The Cooler.
The guy that I play, Shelley Kaplow, is the casino manager of a very rundown, what they call in the script, an old school casino. And I guess the easiest way to describe the ethic there is that, you know, when people owe us money, we don't litigate. We take them downstairs and we beat them with a lead pipe. And it's Bill Macy, who plays the title role, is the cooler, which is an old concept of a guy who, in real terms, a cooler was a guy you sent to a table to disrupt the action of someone who was on a run. So I would bump into you or spill a drink or do something to distract you and break your concentration. And in our movie, we have Bill go, and he's just such bad luck. He literally is like a bad luck charm. And when he just goes and stands next to you or touches your jacket or he's even near you, all of your fortunes just dissolve.
Do you know your way around the casino world?
No, I myself am the cooler in my own personal life. I'm just the worst gambler, and I don't really care about gambling, and I always lose, and I never really gamble. I've been to Vegas a couple times, actually to do research for a movie, and I would play blackjack a couple times, but sports books, sports betting, side bets with my friends, I mean, you name it, anything, I always lose every bet I make. So I'm not a big fan of gambling.
Now, in addition to The Cooler, you're also in The Cat in the Hat, which is, you know, a children's holiday film. Being a father, has that changed how you feel about doing a film that is, you know, a family film primarily geared for kids?
Well, my daughter is 8, and sometimes you can do these movies, and by the time you make the decision to do the movie and the movie is actually released, your child has aged out of the demographic for that movie. So I never really think of my own child. To do films for children at large is interesting to me because, you know, it occurred to me when I did Cat in the Hat that it's such a huge part of the market now. I mean, there are so many films that are made just for kids, and you wind up developing an audience among people that are 5 to 8 years old. I used to do narration for the PBS series Thomas and the Magic Railroad. And then I did the movie Thomas and the Magic Railroad. And I can't get over how I think I have just as many parents and children comment to me about them watching that DVD or video product at home as any other job I've ever done.
So you're kind of creating new fans.
Yeah, you really are. You're like, you have people who, you know, to me, career-wise, I'm a pretty bad person career-wise. You know, I never really was very good at making just career decisions. And, you know, now I'm older and I've done this for a while and I just think I just want to be in a good movie. And whether the part for me is the most splashy role or whether the part is a real opportunity for me critically or what have you, I don't really think about that much. I just think I'd like to hitch a ride on a movie that I think is a good movie.
Alec Baldwin is my guest, and he's starring in 2 new movies, The Cooler and The Cat in the Hat. I thought we could listen to one of your great movie scenes, and this is from the movie Glengarry Glen Ross, which is based on a David Mamet play. The movie is about salesmen who are selling this worthless land, but they have to make it seem like this land is really great and you're getting a really great deal. So the people who they sell to are mostly these real, like, naive losers. So you play the manager who's sent in from the main office to light a fire under these guys and to get them to, like, to keep selling. I'm going to play part of your monologue.
As we're adding a little something to this month's sales contest, as you all know, first prize is a Cadillac Eldorado. Anybody want to see second prize? Second prize, a set of steak knives. Third prize is you're fired. You get the picture? You laughing now? You got leads. Mitch and Murray paid good money. Get their names to sell them. You can't close the leads you're given. You can't close shit. You are shit. Hit the bricks, pal, and beat it, because you are going out.
The leads are weak.
The leads are weak. The f***ing leads are weak. You're weak. I've been in this business 15 years.
What's your name?
You, that's my name. You know why, mister? Because you drove a Hyundai to get here tonight. I drove an $80,000 BMW. That's my name. And your name is your wanting. And you can't play in the man's game. You can't close them. Then go home and tell your wife your troubles. Because only one thing counts in this life. Get them to sign on the line which is dotted. You hear me, you f***ing faggots?
That's my guest, Alec Baldwin, in a scene from Glengarry Glen Ross. That scene must have been so much fun to do because, well, the writing is so good. Can you describe a little bit your approach to learning and digesting that really pretty long monologue and figuring out, like, how you want to pace yourself in it, where the pauses are going to be, how dramatic to get?
Well, you know, the doing that film was interesting because the role that I played was not in the play. And Mamet had added that role to the screenplay for the movie because he felt that they needed to be, we needed to see the stakes raised a little higher at the onset of the film. So he added this scene and we went in there and it was an enormously difficult and unpleasant thing for me to have to do because here were these actors who I loved. Kevin and Jack and Ed and Ark, and I had to go in and really just kind of pee all over them. You know, it was just this horrible scene, you know, in terms of if you did it right, you know, you didn't want to back off. And I just didn't want to do that. You know, they were all getting along so well and all had a great time shooting together. And I walked in to shoot the scene for just 2.5 or 3 days, and because we rehearsed a full rehearsal period prior to the shooting, which is very rare. And so we did that, and, you know, you could tell it was going to be really tough, you know, because, I mean, I was just, I had to be so nasty to these people. And I left, and, you know, I came back, and they started shooting for a couple of weeks. And it was one of those things where you come to work and they're all sitting around the coffee urn and eating a bagel and laughing and having a good time. And I walk in and they're like, oh, you know, Schmucko is here, you know. And I come in and I got to, you know, they know what's coming, which is I got to just kind of singe their hair all day and play the part. And Jamie Foley, I'll never forget, said to me, well, it's like Patton. And it's like when Patton walks in the tent and slaps the soldier in front of all the other men in the medical tent and says, you know, you call yourself a soldier and how dare you disgrace this place of honor and everything. And, you know, to Patton, the deepest affront was cowardice. And so we took that image, you know, and I went into the scene like, you know, you call yourself a salesman. I was going to be the Patton of salesmen. And we just ran with it from there. And I just never backed off. And I think to this day, they probably all hate my guts. You know, I was pretty mean to them.
You never got to share a bagel with them around the coffee urn?
I didn't go to the rap party. And they were all very professional about it and everything. But I guess my point is that doing those really tough scenes is not fun. You know, it really isn't fun. Because to be that person, you know, when you play Hitler or you play Ted Bundy or anybody you play, it's challenging, but it's not really fun. You know, I did Streetcar Named Desire on Broadway quite a while ago, and my friends would come up to me, particularly younger guys, and they'd say, boy, it must be so much fun for you to get up there on stage and get all that out of your system every day. And I said, you know, back then I was 34 years old in 1992, and I said, I realized a couple weeks into the run of the show that I don't have that much in my system to begin with. And that around the second month of the run, I almost wanted to put my arms around Blanche and say, hey, Blanche, why don't you and I sit down and have a drink and try to work this out, you know? Let's be friends. And so all of that contentiousness and all of the that kind of drama with people, it does wear you out after a while.
My guest is Alec Baldwin. He's in two new movies, The Cooler and The Cat in the Hat. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Alec Baldwin, and he's starring in two new films now, The Cooler and The Cat in the Hat. When you started your career, you were, among other things, the young hunk. And I think we know more about how, you know, beautiful actresses, the predicaments they're in and how they're marketed when they're young. We know more about that than we do about, like, the young leading men. What were some of the expectations of you early in your career, you know, as the young hunk?
Oh, God, what I wouldn't give to be the young hunk again. It was so much easier. Well, I look at people today, you know, when I first started making films in the mid-80s and then started starring in films in the late 80s and early 90s, it was slightly different than it is now. And, you know, the film business has evolved so dramatically over the last 20, 25 years. And I remember seeing people years ago who were young and who were very you know, attractive leading men and women, and I felt sorry for them because they were so young, and they had to learn to act in the white hot spotlight of movie stardom. You know, like Rob Lowe is an example,
mm-hmm.
or Brad Pitt, and people who I thought had good performances in them. And sure enough, Rob Lowe turns around 20 years into his career and does West Wing and impresses a lot of people with his acting ability. You know, for myself early on, mm-hmm. when I was starting out, you really have to make that choice early on. Do you want to be a part of that system? A Hollywood studio filmmaking is something where they invite you to, for them to develop you in this way. And if you acquiesce and do whatever they ask you to do, it can be a very thrilling ride. You might not get to act very much. You might not get to be able to perform roles that are that satisfying, but you're going to be a big movie star. You're going to be famous. You're going to have this incredible lifestyle. You're going to be rich. And for many people, that's enough. But for me, I think my early sense of what was good about this business was more theater directed than film directed. I started, the first job I did was a soap opera here in New York. And I remember I was on a cast of a daytime soap with a cast where at any given time, three or four or five people were in a Broadway show at the same time. And that was how I kind of got birthed into the business, was surrounded by those people who said the theater was really the only place that you can be satisfied, you know, as an actor.
Well, that soap opera that you were on was called The Doctors. And, you know, I was wondering if being on a daytime soap early in your career helped you or hurt you in the sense that a lot of people, you know, look down on daytime soaps and think that the acting isn't the best and that good acting isn't even particularly encouraged on it. So, you know, that kind of thing might be held against you. People might almost, you know, snicker at a starring role in a daytime soap. On the other hand, some actors say it's just the greatest experience.
Well, I think, you know, it's a variety of things. One, people don't really understand the dynamic of daytime TV, which is that it evolved from radio. And early daytime television up through the 60s and even the 70s was predicated on the same formula, which is you wanted to turn the TV on Monday. And if you turn the TV on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, we hadn't really proceeded too far from Monday. You know, if you missed the show on Tuesday and Wednesday, when you came back on Thursday, you could pick up right where you left off.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, every Friday program was where we restated all the facts of what had evolved during the week. So I'd say, you know, Terry, I really am glad that you have taken over Palmer Industries now and that you have and that you and Jed are reconciling your divorce. And, you know, there was like a recap and there's a mechanism to it, which is very artificial. But it was about an audience that is a kind of a come and go audience, you know. And for me, it was a great experience because it's professional experience in the extreme, because you have to show up for work and you have to know your lines and you have to make choices, even though the material is less than wonderful, typically, you have to do that on a daily basis. So I think it's a great training ground.
My guest is Alec Baldwin. He's starring in two new films. One is The Cat in the Hat and the other is The Cooler. You're known for being pretty political. You've done fundraisers for the Democratic Party. You were the president of the Creative Coalition, and you and it stood up for the National Endowment for the Arts when it was under attack. Do you think Hollywood is more politically divided than it ever was before? You know, on the one hand, there are, you know, a few liberals like you have been very outspoken. On the other hand, you have like Arnold Schwarzenegger is now the governor of California, and I don't know. Do you feel that Hollywood is more politically divided and more upfront about what those divisions are, that they matter more than they used to?
Well, I think that I think what has happened is that people are a little uneasy because now there's this whole framework out there, this conservative media framework that's going to whip you if you don't speak up too much.
Give me an example of what you mean by that.
Well, I mean, Fox News, I mean, which is, just a joke to me, literally. I mean, although there are good and worthy components of the Fox News operation, you know, there Fox Sports, I think, is great, and there are individual broadcasters on Fox programming that are honorable. And, you know, I think that what they've done is that they've intimidated a lot of people in my business. I mean, you asked about how divided the Hollywood community is. I think a lot of people don't speak up the way they used to because there's a different kind of consequence now. You know, it used to be that you were you just weren't as tormented by this network of people, whether it's Ann Coulter or Limbaugh or Laura Ingraham or you name it. You know, the New York Post Page Six, which is an arm of Murdoch's enterprise, all that kind of stuff. They really mobilize and they really, really attack you and they really, really dissect you pretty effectively now. And some people don't like the heat and they don't like the pain, or they don't like it for their children. You know, because they get kids will, you know, the parents will say, I don't want you to have a play date with this one because of your, literally because of your politics, you know. And I think that people just don't want to be bothered with taking those chances. So a lot of my more liberal entertainment industry colleagues have retreated from the, at least from the media. They'll do their thing privately. They'll go to a private home. They'll write a check. They'll host an event in a private home to raise money. They're involved, but they don't want to get up there in front of the media anymore because they feel that the consequences can be too painful.
Do you feel that Hollywood itself is using politics in a way that it didn't before? I mean, for example, do you think that your political point of view or one's political point of view is taken into account during the casting process or the producing process? If there's a conservative director as a liberal actor unlikely to be hired as a lead, or vice versa, if there's a liberal director as a conservative leading man unlikely to be hired? Do you feel that's happening?
I'm sure it does happen. I haven't really experienced it directly myself. I mean, I'm sure, you know, at the height of something, I mean, this is what your political opponents want to achieve. You know, when you get, you know, when you go to conservative websites and they're really raking you over the coals about something, and there's a lot of protest about, you know, some comment someone might have made, whoever they are, Streisand or Susan Sarandon or whoever, you know, George Clooney got worked over a while ago, and so they do mobilize themselves, some of these conservative groups, with an eye toward damaging your career. That's their goal.
Alec Baldwin, he's in two new movies, The Cat in the Hat and The Cooler. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Books, publishers of Joel Myrowitz's new volume of photography, Tuscany, Inside the Light, with text by Maggie Barrett, available at Barnes & Noble bookstores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Starbucks, offering access to NPR holiday programming through the T-Mobile Hotspot service, available at neighborhood Starbucks during this holiday season. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, growing up on Long Island and becoming an actor. We continue our conversation with Alec Baldwin, also Al Roker of the Today Show, on losing over 100 pounds. Last year he had gastric bypass surgery. He's eating food he loves, but in much smaller portions. He even has a new holiday cookbook. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Alec Baldwin. He's in two new movies, The Cat in the Hat and The Cooler. He just won this year's Best Supporting Actor Award from the National Board of Review for his performance in The Cooler. I know you grew up in Massapequa, Long Island.
Mm-hmm.
And your father was a teacher. What was the subject?
He taught American history and economics.
Would you describe your neighborhood when you were growing up?
Well, it was a real, you know, working class kind of neighborhood. You know, it was real suburban, residential, South Shore, Long Island. And there were people who lived near us, close to the water, that were, you know, more well off. It was kind of a very checkered community that way. And it was, but it was all kids. Everything was about kids. I mean, this is back in a day I kind of characterized where I grew up and when I grew up as probably the last generation when people who didn't have a lot of money had big families on faith. In my neighborhood, there were a lot of people who the father, you know, had a very modest job and a very modest income of whatever nature. And still they had five or six or seven children, you know.
What do you think your image was when you were in high school?
Probably restless. I mean, I was really like into everything and nothing at the same time. Like I joined the drama club and I did that for a couple of years and I quit. And then I played football, and I played football on the football team, but I wasn't really interested in that, and then I quit. And I played lacrosse, and I quit. And I just was, like, really, really struggling to find out what I wanted to do. And then I went away to college to go to GW to study political science and to go to law school, and I quit. You know what I mean? I went there for 3 years, and I kind of saw it didn't really interest me. I guess maybe I had, I don't know, ADD, or we didn't have those acronyms when I was a kid. And when I went to NYU and auditioned for the program and got in and I transferred, I began to settle in because I love New York. I mean, that was a big thing for me, was to move to New York City. And that really helped to engage me, because I just found out, you know, this is where I need to live. This is where I want to be. And then once I started making films, you know, the acting thing was interesting to me. And it was amusing to me in some ways, but it didn't become really, really great until I started to do plays on Broadway and to do films, and mostly the plays. Actually, I'm doing a play in January. I'm starting rehearsals on a revival of the old Hecht MacArthur comedy, The 20th Century, that I'm doing at the Roundabout Theater with Anne Heche. And we're going to do that on Broadway this spring. And, you know, when I started working on really great material that a lot of thought had gone into, and I worked with great directors, like I did Streetcar with Greg Mosier, who I really just is one of the smartest people I've ever met in this business. And I worked with A.J. Antoon and just a lot of cool people as directors, and worked on really, really cool material. And it was fun. You know, it started to become really exciting and fun. And I thought, well, this is who I am. You know, I was always kind of reluctant to say, this is who I am. Even when I was a kid, I said, I don't want to say I'm a jock or I'm a rock and roller or I'm a this, I'm a that. I wasn't quite sure. And then once I started to really feel like I could get my arms around the craft of acting, or the art of it, and maybe make something of it, I wound up like kind of saying to myself, this is what I am.
When you were going to NYU, I think this is when it was, you were also working for a brief time at Studio 54. And I'm sure as a waiter there, you got to see a lot of happening people behaving in bizarre ways. And I wonder if you learned any lessons there about what not to do in public, or, you know, how not to be if you're on the scene.
Well, by the time I worked there in the fall of 1978, 79 rather, it was all over. You know, no one was really going there anymore. I mean, there might be some people would roll in late at night,
mm-hmm.
to just as a pit stop from some other place they were going that was now more, favored. And when I worked there, it was really kind of it was the last gasps, and it closed soon thereafter. Rubel went to prison soon thereafter for tax evasion. And but when I worked there, it was very funny because I just, I was like, you know, I was like Jim Nabors, you know, I was like Gomer Pyle. And I'm working at this big disco with all these people, and I go up into the balcony, and some older guy in a beautiful suit would walk up to me and hand me a $100 bill and say, I want you to go to the deli on 8th Avenue and get me a box of Benson and Hedges in a box, in a box. And I want you to get me a lemonade, and I want you to get me, and he had, like, you know, he had his menu of exactly what he had to have. And it said, I want you to go get that for me and come back and meet me and Enrique up here, my boyfriend, and I'm going to, you know, do something nice for you. Okay, run. And I was like, yes, sir, I'll go get y'all's candy and y'all's cigarettes and everything. And so nice of you to ask me to do this for you. You know, trot off, come back. The guy would give you like $50 and a tip because he wanted to stay up there and, you know, get it on with Enrique in the balcony all night. And, you know, just make sure that my Brandy Alexanders keep coming. And it was just so bizarre to me because this was my introduction to all the exotic birds of Manhattan.
Oh, an interesting lesson in the class structure.
Yeah, right. Go fetch me my drinks. And, yeah, it was weird. It was kind of weird at the first, yeah.
Now, also, when you were at NYU, you did your thesis on Al Pacino and method acting.
Right.
What were some of your observations about the method that you had then when you were just at the very beginning of your acting career?
Well, I think that... most people feel that method acting is something where you have to introduce and kind of haul into the process all this stuff, whether it's necessary or not. And that's not true.
You mean all this like emotional baggage from
all of the methods, the tenets of the method need to all be hauled in and rolled in, as a matter of course, and that's not true. Even Strasberg and Stanislavski and so forth, but Strasberg in particular said, you only use this stuff if you need it. The method had these suggestions that were there on an as-needed basis, and I really learned a lot about that. But more in particular, I mean, I learned a variety of things about Al and his approach. But, I mean, I think the thing that is the most important to me, because Pacino was certainly one of the reasons I'm in this business, I mean, I just grew up so mesmerized by Serpico and his early films and just how dynamic and how charismatic he was and how intense he was and soulful and so forth. You know, Brando and Pacino were probably the two most important people to me at that time. Is that Al, to this day, he just takes it very seriously. You know, it's that acting is important and it's very serious. You know, we did Looking for Richard, his documentary about Richard III. I remember when I worked with Al briefly on the film, I just really loved that he was fun and he's a sweet, funny guy. But more than anything, he's serious about acting. And I like that.
Alec Baldwin, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Alec Baldwin is in two new movies, The Cat in the Hat and The Cooler. Coming up, Al Roker of The Today Show on life after his gastric bypass surgery. He's lost over 100 pounds. This is Fresh Air. Over 100,000 obese people had bariatric surgery this year to decrease the size of their stomachs. The procedure has attracted a lot of attention through public figures who have had it, including my guest Al Roker of The Today Show. Since having the surgery last year, he's lost over 100 pounds, about a third of his body weight. We invited him to talk with us about how this procedure has changed his life, his body, and his love of food. He actually just published a second cookbook, Al Roker's Hassle-Free Holiday Cookbook. Al Roker, welcome to Fresh Air. Your new book is a cookbook of holiday recipes. The winter holidays are, among other things, occasions to overeat. I mean, that's one of the things they're famous for. People, like, stuff themselves at holiday dinners. Are they a difficult time for you now because there's such a limit to what you can eat?
Well, actually, no. They're, in a sense, easier in that I know what my capacity is, and if I exceed that, I won't feel good. And so, in a way, it's somewhat freeing in that I have a little, and I mean little bit of much of what's on the table, and then I move on. So it's pretty freeing.
What's the difference between the signals your body sends you now and the signals your body sent you before the surgery?
Well, I don't think it. I don't think it sent any signals. And now there's a definite signal that you're full. And if you eat any more, you're going to be uncomfortable. And if you eat any more than that, you're going to be ill. But I also have to say right up front that I don't recommend this. I don't recommend the surgery. I don't endorse the surgery. I had a gastric bypass. It worked for me. It may not work for whoever is listening and considering it. It's a dangerous operation. 1 in 200 people die from this every year. A lot can go wrong.
When you were deciding whether or not to go through with the surgery, what was your process of deciding whether you would take the risks or not?
Well, I just decided I was going to do it, and I interviewed several doctors, probably four, in the New York area, and whittled it down to the one that I was most comfortable with. But I didn't tell really my wife until I had decided on that doctor and had already scheduled it, and then told her, and then Deborah said, okay. And the irony is she had done a number of stories on this surgery and had suggested, said, well, I just interviewed Carney Wilson. Now maybe a year earlier, I said, nope. And I obviously wasn't ready for it at that time. And I made the decision in January of 2002, I'm sorry. I had decided, okay, I'm going to do this. And I didn't tell any other than my producer and my wife and actually my representative because I wanted him to know why I was doing this. I didn't tell my family. I didn't tell any of my friends. Didn't tell anybody because it was such a drastic surgery and I didn't want any negativity or anybody saying, oh, what about this? What about that? I'd already made up my mind and I didn't want anything getting in the way. So I went ahead until I had scheduled vacation and luckily, the surgery happened on a Friday, March 15th, and I was back to work the following Monday.
Wow.
A week later.
Huh. So I've read that you can eat about a cup of food at any meal. Is that about right?
Yeah, a cup and a half, I guess, depending. I guess there are ways to bypass this, in that you can, no pun intended, you can, eat small meals constantly so that you're constantly digesting. You can eat. You can drink milkshakes, I suppose, if you can stand that, because a high sugar, high fat food can, or high salt, high fat food can, trigger nausea. And I've had that happen maybe two or three times. And once you have it happen a few times, you don't want, it's like the old, doctor, it hurts when I do that. Well, don't do that. But that said, to me, the trade-off is acceptable. I still eat. For example, when I was doing we entered the rib, the Memphis in May rib championship for the Food Network this past May. And in the old days, I could eat a rack and a half of ribs with no problem. Now, maybe three ribs, tops, more like two. And that's about it. But yet, I'm satisfied when it's done.
Would you have been satisfied after the rack and a half?
Yeah, I guess so, just because I would have been so full. And plus, besides that, there would have been the sides of some baked beans, coleslaw, stuff like that. So it's a different way of eating. It's a way that most normal-sized people actually already do inherently. My wife, who's on ABC 2020, Deborah Roberts, is, she's like a size 2. And she overeats at times. She'll eat a big meal, but... the thing that a thin person or a normal-sized person knows to do that most of us who are overweight don't know what to do is that, she then will throttle back over the next couple of days and she'll exercise. And that's the other component to this. You have to exercise. I mean, this by itself is not a magic bullet. I mean, I work out before the Today Show 5 days a week and sometimes a sixth day because that's what I need to do because it keeps muscle tone and it... And I just feel better when I do it. I mean, I still hate it. I hate exercise. I mean, I have a trainer 3 of those 5 days, and my goal is to get really fit enough to at some point just beat the crap out of them. just really whap them. Just drop them like a bag of dirt.
As you've pointed out, if you're addicted to alcohol or to a drug, you can stop taking it. You can stop drinking, but you can't stop eating. So the so you're always around the thing of temptation.
Well, you're not only always around it; you actually need it to survive. I mean, you don't have to drink alcohol or Bloody Marys or whatever to live. You don't have to take crack to live, but you do have to eat.
How many pounds have you lost?
About 120.
It's a lot.
Yeah, I always say to my wife, I've lost you,
Do you feel like your self-image has changed in any fundamental way?
No. It took a while to catch up, from who you see yourself as. I mean, I still basically, I mean, still to a certain point expect, when I talk about weight issues, I still count myself as a person who's overweight. Because actually, technically, I probably am, not morbidly obese anymore or even obese. But, at 200 pounds, and if you follow the charts, I'm probably still 20 pounds overweight, maybe 25 pounds overweight. But, I look at old pictures or I look at old video and I go, oh, my God. I mean, I think I had stopped looking at myself, really, because it was just too difficult to look at. You can fool yourself to a certain period of time and say, oh, well, I'm not that overweight or whatever. But, you get up over, north of 300 and you're overweight unless you're like, 7'3" and I'm 5'8". So that's, I always said I wasn't overweight. I was just too short for my weight. I'm the perfect weight for a guy who's 7'2".
Now that you've lost, I think you said about 120 pounds, are there things that you do now that you couldn't have done before or that you didn't feel comfortable doing before?
Well, yeah. We live in a brownstone, and before this, I could not carry my daughter up to her floor, which she's on the top floor. I just couldn't do it. And, your kids come in from, you've been out to grandma or whatever, and they fall asleep in the car. And, in a normal house, you would just kind of pick them up, hoist them over your shoulder and carry them into the house. Maybe you have to walk up one flight of stairs. In our house, it's four. And, my daughter's a good, solid little girl. And I couldn't do that before. And I've done it now. I did the New York City all city bike tour last May, 50-mile bike tour. I was in Miami a couple of weeks ago, and I actually went for a run. I never thought I would ever say that. I went for a run, not voluntarily. Run, the hotel's on fire. That kind of, but not, I'm going out for a run. I never thought I would say that.
My guest is Al Roker of The Today Show. He has a new holiday cookbook. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Al Roker of The Today Show, and he has a new book called Al Roker's Hassle-Free Holiday Cookbook. When you started your career, was your aspiration to be a weather person, weatherman, or just to be a broadcaster?
To be to be perfectly honest, I didn't even want to be on television. And there's a true story. I had a department chairman. I went to SUNY Oswego, which is in upstate New York, mm-hmm. and in the radio and TV department. And Dr. Lou O'Donnell said to me after we did a television performance class, he said, Roker, you have the perfect face for radio.
We people in radio hate that joke.
I know. I understand. I could tell by the silence that was, if you just fill that in with crickets, but it's true. I'm not your typical and didn't see myself as your typical person on television. So I didn't really plan on it. But ironically, it was that same professor who put me up for the job in Syracuse, New York, when I was a sophomore, to do weekend weather at the CBS station, and I got the job. And quite frankly, I mean, I love radio. I mean, I did it in college. I did it early part of my career. I love radio. But like I said, I didn't plan to do this. I didn't plan to, or I certainly didn't think that this would be my career track. I thought, well, I'd just do this till I could get a job either producing or writing, and then I'll get out of it and go on from there. But it didn't happen. I just kept getting jobs for whatever reason. I mean, I was lucky. I mean, I think, you know, for some reason, in fact, I can sum it up. I think I was in a cab. This was a couple of years after I'd gotten my job here in New York, and I got in, and the cab driver starts the meter, and we're driving, and he looks in the rearview mirror, and he said, you're Al Roker, aren't you? I said, yeah. He goes, listen, don't take this the wrong way, but you don't look like somebody who's on TV. You look like somebody I'd know. And I think, you know, that's, I really don't look like I should be on TV.
So listen, in the morning when you leave the house, do you ever call the weather?
Oh, no, because here's the deal. I've got to, my routine is this. I get up at about 3:30. I call our meteorologist, a young man named Don Sunikas. We confer over the internet. We look at maps and come up with the forecast. I leave my house at about 4:10, 4:15. I get to the gym at 4:30. I work out till 5:30. I take a steam. I'm over at the Today Show by 10 of 6. And then I start. So I pretty much know what the weather, even on days that I'm off, because people expect me to know what the weather is, I have to, before I leave the house, I go on the internet, I look at the maps and get an idea of what the weather is. And even still with that, my wife will say, you know, I hear they say it's going to be sunny out today. And I'll look at her and say, what is this they say crap? I'm they. It's what I say, not they, me.
What's the worst call you ever made?
Ooh, worst call. I'll never forget. It was the first time I was really wrong. I was working in Syracuse, and there's a big Italian street festival every year. And our station had a booth and the whole nine yards, and it was great. And I was saying, oh, come on down. It's going to be great. A beautiful, sunny Saturday afternoon. It'll be wonderful. And I was there with some friends. And, you know, the day was beautiful, started out, and I could see these clouds building to the northwest. And I thought, uh-oh. And they just started getting darker and darker. And I kind of grabbed my friends. I said, very slowly, walk toward the car. And as the sky really starts getting dark, I can see people saying, I know, I could hear this murmur. You know, I thought it was supposed to be nice. Al Roker said, where is Al? There he is! Get him! You know, so we break out for a run to the car just as the skies opened up and, you know, peel out of the parking lot. It was just, it was horrible.
Your father's family is from the Bahamas. Your mother's family is from Jamaica. Are there special holiday foods, I mean, special foods in general that you grew up with?
Well, yeah. It's funny because the Caribbean, there's a tradition called Boxing Day, which stems from a British tradition, but that the people in the big house, whether it's master or you know, boss or whatever, would bring, box up their leftovers and things that they didn't want right after Christmas and bring them to either the servants, the slaves, whatever you want to call them. And so we would have Johnny cake. My grandmother would make Johnny cake. She'd make what's called Benny, which is a sesame candy. My father's mother would make this killer rum cake. That, you know, I would wait to get this thing at college because you'd take the top of the tin off and literally you would be knocked down by the fumes from the rum. I mean, you know, people had a contact high over half my dorm floor. But food has always been, and I think with most families, I think food is a major component of most of your holiday memories. In my family, I write this in the Al Roker's Hassle-Free Holiday Cookbook. My mother makes this dish called sweet potato poon. And it's basically a crustless sweet potato pie. And every year the same thing happens. And yet it wouldn't be the holidays without it. You have to top it with marshmallows, and then you brown them under the broiler. And my mother would have the broiler open, and she'd be watching the marshmallows brown because they'll catch fire pretty quickly. And one of us will go and distract her. Say, Mom, where's the serving spoons? Mom, do you have the coasters? Mom. And she'll look away for about 30 seconds, and before you know it, the marshmallows have caught fire. So it's not really the holidays in our house unless the smoke detector goes off. But it's fun.
Well, Al Roker, I wish you happy holidays. Thank you very
you too,
much
Terry.
For talking with us.
Thank you.
Al Roker's new book is called Al Roker's Hassle-Free Holiday Cookbook. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with a 1949 recording featuring Pearl Bailey and Hot Lips Page.
Gee, Hot Lips, you got a nice place here, and I've been enjoying myself, but I've got to go now.
Oh, don't leave now.
But I got to go, I tell you. I really can't stay.
But baby, it's cold outside.
Can't help it, I've got to go away.
But baby, it's cold outside.
This evening has been...
I've been hoping that you'd drop
so
in.
So very nice.
I'll hold your hands. They just like ice.
My mother will start to worry.
Beautiful, what's your hurry?
And father will be pacing the floor.
Listen to the fireplace roar.
Really, I'd better scurry.
Beautiful, please don't hurry.
Well, if you insist, I'll have
put some
a
more records
a
on
drink more.
While I pull.
You mean Harmony Records? The neighbors will faint.
But baby, it's bad out there.
I can't help it. Man, what did you put in this drink?
Look, it's no cabs to be had out there.
I wish I knew how.
Your eyes are like starlights
break
now.
Break the spell.
I'll take your help. Your hair looks well.
Well, I ought to say no, no, no,
mind
sir.
If I move in close to...
Of course not. I'm gonna say that I tried.
What's the sense of hurt?
I really can't stay.
Oh, baby, don't hold out.
Oh,
baby,
but it's cold outside. I'm not kidding now, Hot Lips. I'm telling you, I've got to get home.
But, baby, you'd freeze out there.
You think so?
Yeah.
Well, lend me your coat.
You know what? It's up to your knees out there.
Is it that deep?
It's really bad.
But you've been so very grand.
I thrill when you touch my hand.
But don't you see?
How can you do this thing to me?
Oh, I'm not really cruel, but there's bound to be talk tomorrow.
Think of my lifelong sorrow.
Well, there'll be plenty implied.
If you caught pneumonia and
can't
die.
Can't help it, I really can't stay.
Get over that doubt.
Baby, it's cold
outside.
You know, Lips, I tell you, I want to believe you so much. I think I'll look out the window and see if it's still snowing. Say, who's that woman downstairs up front?
Oh, that's just a friend of mine.
Oh, you want me to go there? Oh, no, indeed. I'm
tapes
not
and transcripts of Fresh Air are available at 1-877-213-7374 or on the internet at www.burrells.com. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a financial services company serving nearly 3 million members. Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, where values thrive. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
HBO is showing its movie adaptation of Tony Kushner's play Angels in America. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Tony Kushner. He also has a new musical called Caroline or Change that's being performed at the Public Theater in New York. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.